Okay, good morning. This is Monday, February 16th, 2009. This is Peggy Van Skoik, and I'm in the home of Carolyn Sampson. She's agreed to be interviewed with us this morning. So, we started out this morning, you were beginning to tell me about your educational background, that you were born in Raleigh, is that right?
Correct. Born in Raleigh.
Okay.
And lived in Raleigh most of my life. And until I moved away and lived in New York State for 13 years. While here, I had friends. I went to school, but we had gotten up to the point where I was telling you about my high school experience, I think, and the fact that my parents, my African American parents, always encouraged education, get your education, because I want you to do better than me. And I, for one, bought into that, you know. I have two sisters and one brother. My older sister is deceased now, but I have a younger sister. And Joanne eventually finished school in Oklahoma. And my brother, he was an art major at St. Augustine's. I'm not sure whether he finished his degree or not. I don't know. But at any rate, I guess we all, at some level, really believed in what our parents were preaching and did try to
make something out of ourselves,
so to speak. Anyway, In that effort, you know, I first entered when I left high school at J.W. Lincoln. I went to school for about 2.5 years at St. Augustine's, and then I moved away and worked a while, got married somewhere in there, and had a child, and so it was with child that I eventually made that, you know, reconnection with college, and I did so while I was in New York State. At the time, I was working for the Tryon School for Boys, which is persons in need of supervision. That's what they used to call them in New York. And a lot of my work has been in that area. So I've done that. That's juvenile delinquency, and that's what I did for 13 years. It was interesting that, you know, I was at a socialization, I was at a party. We used to do more, as workers, we used to socialize more, I did, while I was in New York, than I do here in the South, you know. I don't know why that is. But anyway, it was at one of those parties that one of the guests was telling me that they had gone to school at SUNY on some kind of a grant. You know, and they didn't have to pay anything. Well, you know, I was listening. I'm always listening. I'm always picking up information, you know. I'm always wanting to know. So I paid attention. And they told me, you know, their contact or whatever. So I made contact with, I'll never forget his name. His name was Mr. Buck. Yeah, strange, you remember the movie. Anyway, his name was Mr. Buck. So I made an appointment to see Mr. Buck. And when I got there, you know, I told him why I was there, and he began to tell me how I would not qualify for this grant. And I listened to him. So when he was done, I says, "Are you finished?" And he said, "Yes, I am." I said, "Mr. Buck, I really didn't come down here for you to tell me how I did not qualify. I came down here for you to tell me how I could." And he sat up straight in his chair, and he says, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from North Carolina." He says, I knew it. I married one of those North Carolina women. And, you know, to make a long story short, he stopped talking to me in the negative and began to tell me how to position myself to be eligible to receive the EOC grant money. And before, again, to make a long story short, I did get accepted into the program, and you know, and you weren't supposed to make any income or anything, you know, because he told me to quit my job, which I did, And then, you know, I couldn't make it. I mean, I'm a single mother by this time. And he worked it out and allowed it that my books and things were taken care of, and also I could get employment. So I worked at LaSalle School as a tutor, and worked like a Trojan. You know, I mean, I was with all of the young people at this point, but here I am. I'm a divorced woman with a child. And, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of time to fool around, you know, in school. I had to get it done quickly and get on back in the work world, you know. So he allowed me to, you know, put all these pieces together so that I could hold on and make it. And what I did was, you know, in that last semester, I had become friends. Well, everybody becomes my friend when I meet them, but my counselor signed my card before it was all filled up. So I filled the card to get everything I needed. You know, I mean, I'd gone through this semester. I went semester, not even taking off for, you know, like summer or anything. And that last time I said, I need 25 hours to get out of here and be done with this so I can go on. And I did. He signed the card and I filled it up. Now, I want you to know that when you ask me how you're doing and I say I'm a-doing, oh, I was a-doing. It wore me out, you know. But I did complete. And then when I got back, I was working at the Tryon School, as I indicated. And Mr. Zirin was the superintendent at that time. Mr. Z, I used to call him. And I get home after I'm all done. I'm in a rest period. And the phone rings. And it's Mr. Zirin. He used to stutter. He says, Carolyn? And I said, yeah, Mr. Z, what's up? He said, how would you like to have a job? And I said, that would be great. So again, to make a long story short, Mr. Z hires me back. When I was there working as a teacher's aide, I think I may have been making maybe $6,000. So at that time, I went from $6,000 to about $22,000 at the same place, okay? So that wasn't so bad then. I mean, it was really okay. And that began my sojourn, or continued my sojourn in New York and with the division of that Division of Facility Services that was here, but the New York State Division for Youth is where I worked. So I started with what I call a frontline service. That's direct service to children and adolescents. And then I grew from that to becoming the Community Involvement Program Coordinator, and therefore covered a 20-county area. And did a lot of things in that position, which grew me, you know, in some areas. But it also, you know, after I started working with the kids, I got to the place where I thought, you know, if you want to make changes, and, you know, it's like we have all these people down there in central office who are making all these decisions about, you know, what is needed on the front line, and they know absolutely nothing. This is where I'm just telling you what I felt. They know absolutely nothing. And so maybe what I need to do is to be a part of that group so that I can bring some, you know, shorten the distance between what is real and what you think is needed and going on. And so that moved me from direct service to administrative. So I went to central office. And in that community involvement program capacity, I sat on the, you know, the we were on the boards and sat in the meetings of the folk who were around making major decisions, and was able to bring that input. And well, that's Carolyn's life, you know, moving from the South to New York. So I did that for 13 years. It was extremely cold. I am not, you know, I mean, maybe that's part of the Southerness in me. You know, I really never, they used to tell me, Carolyn, you should make friends with the weather. You know, take up cross-country skiing or something, you know. And I tried that. But as soon as I get out in the weather, my feet would freeze, my hands would freeze, and my nose. I was just miserable. You know, I never could rise above that. So eventually, I came back home because the weather drove me out of New York. York State. And when I returned here, I didn't work for a while, but I'm always doing volunteer things. So I volunteered to be on, at that point, Sarah Morrow was the... I've gotten a little back. Remember, because you didn't have. And I said, I beg to differ. All right? And I says, and who do I have to talk to beyond yourself? And of course, she began to stutter, because I don't think she expected that I, this African American, would call back and take exception. And so, in a way, I can't say that I didn't get started in the state of North Carolina without some innuendo or some business of, you know, trying to exist in as a black person in a white administration, or, you know, the whole nine yards. Anyway, that's what I felt. And in response to that, I had to buckle up, you know, and just stand my ground, which I did. And now, at the time, my uncle worked for the state of North Carolina. Not in high places, but he was the mail carrier, and he carried mail to the governor, and Jim Hunt was in at that time, you know what I'm saying? And he was a likable guy. We're likable people. Okay? And so he was his friend. He said, my niece is back in town, and she needs a job. And later, when I don't know if you recall, you probably weren't here then, but there was a hullabaloo in Jim Hunt's administration at some point, and you know, all kinds of investigations and things were going on. And one of the things that turned up in this whole event was there was a must-hire list, and my name was on it. Instead of nobody from somewhere, you know. And that began a whole lot of, you know, but anyway, it also sort of cleared up some of what happened to me in that whole process. They did have to renege on that business of I was not qualified, so they couldn't go there. But the person who had to hire me was not happy, because she, you know, they had some plans for that position. But Carolyn shows up, and they have to take me on. But they didn't make anything easy. I mean, it's like I wound up with a desk and an office and a trash can. And all right, do your job, all right? So, and at that time I was hired as a contracts consultant for daycare department. And I oversaw what they call the Cadillac of daycare centers in western part of North Carolina. There were 29 counties out there, so I wound up being responsible for those. And it was all federally funded or state, but it was coming from somewhere outside the state. However, these funds could not go directly to the programs. They had to be funneled through the state of North Carolina. And therefore, I was the person who was hired to oversee that process. Well, As it turns out, the main office for the for those funds that came in, one was in Atlanta and the other was in Washington, D.C. And they had a meeting. They called a meeting. Of course, my people, you know, who didn't tell me anything, they could not allow me to come to this meeting. We go to the meeting, Peggy. And the rep from D.C. and the rep from Georgia were black. My people were quite stunned. Okay? Me? I was very happy. I thought, oh, our people are here. We can communicate. And so they took me to lunch after that meeting. You know, that's how you do things. You know, I know you know. Anyway, they took me to lunch. And they proceeded to fill me in on all that I needed to know. And if I had any questions, I had a direct line to D.C., a direct line to Atlanta, and those two people, all right? That is how I was able to get my feet planted. And, you know, I believe that, yeah, I'm a believer, and God has taken care of me in all my places that I've been, and I've had some stuff that I've had, a job I've had to do. And so, you know, while we may have wanted to put up hurdles, we couldn't do that. We're talking about a $6 million project that was being handled by Carolyn Sampson, you know. I mean, I was placed in that position. And the state didn't, you know, I was the one who kept up with those projects and put even, you know, down to the budgets and stuff like that. And these people gave me carte blanche in terms of all the info I needed to know and the help I needed, you know, when all was said and done. So granted, my people were not happy campers where I worked. And life didn't become easy. It was always a struggle from their perspective. And so I worked against the current of all the times that I was there, but I did manage to get my work done. And was an outstanding employee, you know. Now, there came a point, it's a period where I was able to get away. There was another job posted, and you know, it came to me by one of the secretaries who, like I tell you, everybody I meet becomes my friend. So in passing, she says, well, Carolyn, she just came by, she just dropped by. You know how your friends drop by and sit down, and she says, you know, there's this this position in our department that's coming up, and I think you ought to apply. So I said, well, what is this? So she brings me the, you know, the sort of the, you know what I mean, that
job description.
Yes. And I read it, and I said, I qualify for this. So I applied. And within, I would say, 10 days, things were processed, and I was moved. And that's when I began to work for the Group Care Facilities Branch in the Division of Facility Services. Both of these programs were in the Division of Facility Services. Again, to make a long story short, my people over on the other side, they were totally upset. It's like, how can you do this? And I'm thinking, it was a done deal by then, you know. I mean, it had already been worked out, signed, sealed, and delivered. And I gave my notice, and I was out of there. But they didn't like it.
So now they're unhappy that you're leaving.
Yeah, unhappy.
And they were unhappy that you were there.
Right. Can you believe it? I thought it was just that we weren't orchestrating it, you know. And while I was with them, they demoted me, actually. So we went through. And you know how they did it? They went to the personnel folk and had them come in and do an audit. And they audit my position and some other person. Oh, actually, it was another gal. She was white. Well, she winds up being placed in, because money goes along with these. And so whatever position they created where the money fit, she got to be over me, and therefore I was demoted exactly. So anyway, I lived through that because somewhere in my psychic, in my spirit, it's choose your battles, you know. And I liked her. She was really very good to work with. And so, you know, I did that journey. But when this other thing came up and I was able to move, that was my, you know, that was my thing to do, and I did. And coming in that position, there was one consultant, mental health consultant at the time, to handle 100 counties in the state of North Carolina. Impossible job, all right? She wasn't very good at it, to tell you the truth. It would be truthful. She was terrible. Anyway, so I come along. I don't really know anything about it, but I have to learn a lot. And it was like, you know, throw you in. My boss just sort of gave me the guidelines and said, you know, this is your job, do it. Well, what is going on right now? Now, they wouldn't tell you this, but I'm going to tell you. What's going on in the Division of Facility Service for Mental Health is based on what Carolyn Sampson created, because at the time that I got there, they didn't have any guidelines, they didn't have any, well, they didn't have a plan of work, you know. And so they now had two people, me and this other gal, and we then had the 100 counties to deal with, to license mental health, substance abuse, and mental health, DD, and substance abuse facilities in the state of North Carolina.
Now, what is DD?
Developmentally disabled.
Oh.
So all those programs that exist in the state of North Carolina have to be licensed by the group care facility branch. And there was two of us to do that job. So how it got separated is that she did initials and I did renewals, but I covered 66 counties. When I came on the job, I had a coverage of 66 counties, and then you can subtract out of that the counties that she had. And then I thought, well, I've got to work up a plan of how I'm going to do this or make some semblance of being in touch with everybody. Again, it was an impossible job, but there must be a way. So I worked out a plan where I did 100% contact now in my territory, and I had over 10,000 facilities to see in some form or fashion, whether it was on paper, I'm being in touch with them, I'm making phone calls. I handled anywhere from 300 to 400 calls a month, you know. I kept track of all this stuff too. But I was making my visitations, you know, and I made it in such a way that it could happen. And I made myself open, you know, to these individuals, because I thought, here we're dealing with a population of individuals who can't look out for themselves. Somebody's got to be on top of it. And that, for that period of time, was Carolyn Sampson. Anyway, my life was going along okay. I mean, I worked hard. We had to do at least 1,400 miles on our car. We all had, because it was a territorial kind of thing. So I did a lot of driving around the state of North Carolina, and every month we had the minimum you could have on your car was 1,400 miles. So, and then I also have family too. You know, I mean, by this time I have three kids, and still single parent, you know, and doing what I can do. But I did. I did do my due for the state of North Carolina and for the mental health individuals in this state. And then I was known as, I used to go places and they'd say, oh, so you're that Carolyn Sampson. I wasn't quite sure what they meant by that, but I ran a fair ship, you understand me? I treated everybody the same, I didn't care who you were. And I remember there's a, you know, you have this Cadillac of a program aficionados or whatever you want to call them, and in the going down toward the coast, there was this one guy, and he called a meeting. You know, he wanted to have a meeting because he wanted all of his people to hear from the horse's mouth. I was the horse. What the deal was going to be. Well, I had no idea that, sometimes there was an older lady in my church who I would get to ride with me, particularly if I was going 4 or 5 hours away. And she went with me on this particular trip, and when we get there for this meeting, I walk in. There were about 20 people around the table. I made a meeting with him, And when I get there, there's a room full of people, which is intimidating, you know, to say the least. However, I sat at this end of the table, he sat at the other end, you know, like we're sitting. And he proceeds to do his little thing and talk. And then he gives me the floor. And I say again, I had to pull a Mr. Buck on him. I had to say, well, you know, you can continue to do it that way, but you will be written up. I said, I will be forced to write you up as being in noncompliance. So, if you want to be in compliance, these are the things that you will have to do, and you'll have to do them and report and fill out my reports, et cetera, et cetera. And again, he sat up in his chair, and he turned to all his 10,000 people and sort of said, and this young lady here will be your contact, and whenever she calls and whatever she wants, you make sure you get her the information. And you know this guy, whenever I was coming to his territory, he assigned one of his workers to me. It was almost like he met me at the train station. He put me in his car, and he drove me everywhere I needed to be in that area, you know, lunch, dinner, the whole nine yards. I was treated like a queen, right? But they did excellent work. They satisfied, you know, what I needed. And then we developed a workable relationship with one another. And they were able to bring their programs into compliance, because that's all I was asking for, which is right, you know? It really, if you're going to do this, you need to do it right. So anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But I have had a good life, I think, in terms of the things that I've been able to do and the lives I've been able to affect. I'm not the president of the United States yet, but I have done my due, right? All with my North Carolina education. And
so now, did you retire from your...
I self-retired. Because I ran into another, what would you call it, discrimination, I guess. It was at the time of evaluations, you know, and you get evaluated every year. And in this particular, well, for one thing, the lady who hired me into group care eventually retired. And I didn't get her job. Some guy from outside of the place, he came in and he took over her job. Well, we were going along, and he brought me in for my interview. And he said to me, no, prior to this, I'd had complete outstandings. I'd always been an outstanding employee, you know, like 100%. I worked very hard at my job, and I earned every outstanding I received. And he said, you know, we're into this process, and we can't show all over a certain number of outstandings. And so, again, to make a long story short, what he was leading me to say is, you know, I can't give you an outstanding. Well, on the back side of that, what he really was trying to do was position the one girl who was there when I came for a step up in leadership. And so he couldn't do that in giving me an outstanding. And he took away, he gave me less than outstanding for that review. And I took exception to that, and I filed a grievance. And while, you know, it goes, you have to go through so many changes, it was progressing up the line, they continued to just harass me, you know, in my position and in my job, and just all kinds of things. In fact, you know, I could pull out some things now where, you know, I'm getting all these kinds of emails about, you know, what did you do, and how did you do it, et cetera, et cetera. And so finally, my report gets to the second person in charge within the division, and it gets held up. Now, that person was an African American. So it's not all the white people, you know. So he was what I consider a gatekeeper, and it stopped there. Well, in the meantime, with all this other stuff going on, I decided enough is enough. And I went into work this day and I wrote my resignation. I sent it via email, but then I got up because I didn't think anybody was there. I was told that nobody was working, neither the chief or the assistant was in the house. They were supposed to be out of town to a meeting. But I took a hard copy around to put in his inbox, and he was standing in the door. So I gave it to him in his hand. And then I went back to my office and proceeded to pack up. To this day, he never said a mumbling word to me. If I had been in his shoes, just out of curiosity, you know, so you didn't care for me, maybe. Maybe that's why you're... But I would have had to ask, why? What are you going to do? You know, I'd had to ask something, you know. Just my nature wouldn't have allowed me. He never said a mumbling word. So I packed up my stuff and I left, and I took care of all my business with the personnel people. And when I went back to do the final, the personnel folks were and made friends with the people in the personnel office too. And they said, Carolyn, you have upset everybody in this place. One, I guess I was African American, female. You weren't supposed to just say, forget you, and leave, you know, because people think that you can't, they can fire you, but you can't remove yourself from some situations. And I really think that that's true, you know, that most people do. And so they were upset that I guess they couldn't make me suffer anymore. I left there and I never looked back, because my feeling was I serve a risen God and he has taken care of me this far. He's not going to leave me now. And I've managed, you know, maybe not at the same level. I was making fairly good by that time, but not good enough. I should have been making much more money, but I was able to fend for me and my family. Anyhow, when they see me now, for a period there, I was doing research for a lawyer, and he took on cases of clients who were in these facilities who were abused, neglected, or even died, you know, that kind of thing. Some of them died while in care, and I was the researcher. You know, I would go in and do the research for him, search the records and things like that. So they saw me in a different capacity, was not tied to the state. Initially, they tried to have some reticence about giving me copies of information, but you know, all that information is public record. And then I decided at that time, I don't work for these dudes. I came out and I called the governor's office. And of course, to make a long story short, I never had any more trouble because somebody from there called them and said, don't do that. You know, whatever it was they were thinking about doing, they couldn't do that. And they got the word to all their people that when she comes in, give her what she asked for, you know. And so that worked out very well for this lawyer because, one, I'd created many of the records that were there. You know, I could read down and I'd see, this is submitted by Carolyn Sims. But I also knew the system. You know, I was a mental health person and I knew the system. I was a regulator. That's part of what our job was to regulate these facilities. And so that worked really well for families, you know, who had causes, and for the lawyer who had to do the research to, you know, to get the info that he needed to wrap his case up, so to speak.
Did you see a lot of discrimination in those cases, or what was going on in those facilities?
Actually, what I saw, in many of the ones that I dealt with, it was not so much a black and white thing as it was just injustice toward people who can't help themselves. You know, when you're in need, I even think about that is just being in the hospital. If you have a need, that may not be the place for you to be, because one, they weren't paying very much for their employees to work, And consequently, you get that level of employee, right? And they take shortcuts, you know. But many of these cases, like, you know, where you're into ICFMR, which really means that you need skilled nursing, or you're in rest homes, you know, you really need skilled nursing, or you're going to need a lot of care. The patients were not being cared for very well. They weren't being watched, you know. And when I saw, in the cases that I dealt with, I saw more of that. And they can be cruel to you, too. You know, it was before my older sister died. She was in care. And we would go to see her. And she'd have bruises on her body, you know. Now, she was thin like you, thinner. And then her clothes weren't there, you know, her clothes were missing, that kind of thing. But that also said to me, because I, you know, you really have to show up in these places when you have relatives who are there. I'm sure, now, her disposition, you know, her ailment caused her to not be the easiest person. But yet, still, you are there as a caretaker, you know. Not in a ruse, not to become angry with these people and handle them in such a way that you hurt them. You know? So for his cases even, some of them were manhandled, you know, abused, not treated very well, not taken care of, you know, you know, when bed sores and things like that. It's not so much that some of that, a lot of that has to do with how much care, how much rotation, you know, happens with these individuals. If individuals are allowed, if they're incontinent, and then you don't clean them up, you know, in as timely a fashion, well, they become irritated. Their skin becomes irritated by that, and then that increases to other things, you know. Clients wandered. One of them who died in one of the cases that I dealt with, he had Alzheimer's or something, and so he had wandered away from the facility. He wasn't being watched. You know, you have to say that he wasn't being watched. The exposure to the elements, you know, wiped them out. But anyway, so it was more of that kind of thing. Now, my sister happened to be African American. I don't know how much of that was a part of her care. I didn't think along those lines. I just thought about what I didn't see was happening in just care, whether she was white or black, and then a lot of the bruising and thing. And we found that we had to be in there quite often. When you're in and out, then, you know, they tend to spend a little bit more time taking care of you than they do otherwise. Anyhow, she and I and the rest of my siblings were products of schools in this area, you know.
Before I turned the tape on, you were telling me that your primary education was all in predominantly black schools.
Black
so
schools.
Your elementary school was a black school in Raleigh.
At that time.
Mm-hmm. Hunter?
Hunter Elementary School.
And it was all black at
it
that time.
It was all black at that time.
And then you went to Ligon High School, which at that time was also an all black school.
Exactly.
Right.
And it's now, I think it's now a magnet of some sort. I believe it's a magnet school.
I believe it
school.
Is.
And that certainly mixed it up, you know, somewhat. Because we've got kids coming in from everywhere. I never rode a bus.
You didn't?
No, I was never bused anywhere. I walked to school. It was within walking distance. In the earlier days, I was on Battery Drive, and I walked to Hunter. And when we moved to Ligon, we were on Home Street, which is very, very near Ligon High School. So, you know, we were able to walk there, you know, as well. And then by the time I got to college, I did have a piece of a car. In fact, I think I got that car to go back and forth to school. But my daddy found it was a Chrysler New Yorker.
Wow.
Yeah. It was in really good shape. And he worked on it. He taught me how to change oil and tire and, you know, check on this and that, you know, under the hood. And so I was able to do that and get myself back and forth, you know, to school.
So that's when you were going to St. Augustine's?
St. Augustine's.
Yeah.
That's where I started. Yeah. And to work, because, you know, we had to work. Now, and I wanted to work, because when I worked, I had my own money, and you could do what you want. You know, by that time, I was becoming a little fashion conscious, you know. And while my parents were able to, you know, keep me in clothes, but they couldn't, you know, they weren't going to go the whole nine yards. So when I started making some money, then I could do that, you know, I could step it up a notch, you know. And so I've been working for a long time. The very first job that I had here in North Carolina was for the North Carolina Mutual Burial Association. Very glamorous. Well, and when I got there, they were behind 6 months in their filing. Isn't that horrible? They had one person in the office. Anyway, I was able to, you know, to get that all taken care of. They rather liked me. So I went from there to it had something to do with mental health. And I was a secretary in their office. Maybe that'll come to me at some point. But anyway, so those were my first two jobs in North Carolina. And from there, I got concentrated in school. And from school, my sister and her husband were working in the training schools in the Division for Youth facilities in New York. And so she asked me to come up, and I did. And that's how I got my, I went up during the summer program. And from the summer program, I got hired on at Tryon School for Boys. And, you know, things moved from there. Anyway.
So now you are the president of Carrie's Division of Dream Fest?
It's the Martin Luther King Jr. Task Force of Carrie.
Oh, that I'm okay. The official.
And Dream Fest is one of our initial initiatives.
Okay. And, well, now tell me about that. How did you get involved, and what all do you do?
Well, I got involved. It wasn't even called the task force at that time. It was a committee, the MLK committee, for this area. And it originated between Good Shepherd, United Church of Christ, and at that time, the Carrie United Church of Christ, and they have since changed. You know, they're no longer a member of the UCC. You know, during the time that there was all this business about gay liberalism and what have you, they took exception to that. So they removed themselves from the UCC piece and changed their name. But anyway, those were the two churches that started this whole MLK celebration for the town of Carrie. I have to remind them, too. I feel like I do anyway. And during, I got involved around 1995.
Okay. How long have they been in existence to that
point? I want to say 1995 was...
So first year.
Yeah, very first year, or the second, or what, somewhere in there. So maybe it was 94. But in all of my records, I have it as 1995. And I just came on as a volunteer, you know, committee member or whatever. And at that point, as I said, it was the two churches who were doing it, and they did a service. They would do the service, and they did a march. I think they tried to do the march thing, and the service. And somehow, again, you know, I'm processing so much information, but as I remember, I became the chairperson of the events or the program committee or something like that. And I proposed, I said, well, you know, you've done such a good job in developing this relationship between the black church and the white church. Maybe you need to spread this, you know, open yourselves up to spread this and see if we can't grow this around the town of Carrie.
So the Good Shepherd was the African American?
That's the white church.
Okay,
and the Carrie First is what it's called.
Carrie First
is the Black Church.
Church of Christ. Mm-hmm. Is, okay.
They're located over here on Davis Drive, and Good Shepherd is off of Maynard.
Okay.
But they had this relationship over the years, and what they did was every fifth Sunday, one or the other was in each other's church. So the Blacks would come over and perform the worship for Good Shepherd and vice versa. And then in that, they had fellowship time. You know, there was always a meal served afterwards so that people could get to know one another. And they may have also communicated or worked with each other in other kinds of ways. But that was a relationship, you know, and I have all kinds of pictures, you know, regarding that. But anyway, those guys began this piece, and